This is
地球好辣
Super hot. You are now listening to Green Development and Taiwan. My name is James.
This is Mountain. 'm a creative person, but like to interpret law, like you have to be creative, to be honest. Because sometimes, like especially in the field of sustainability, like it's a uncharted territory, I can say, if I think I can put it that way. Because like everything is so different and like changes all the time. Like there's just too many things that it's still on the beginning phase, and everybody's just try and error, so sometimes it is not even a law, sometimes it's just a social norm or like social norm between industries, with or just among industries. For me, I feel like yeah, you have to be creative because you have to too many like different contexts. Like every business has their different size, different stakeholders, like, and I mean like for example, like if you are like a renewable energy companies, or you try to start up a solar power panels projects in the communities, but this kind of experience cannot be 100% success example for another communities. So in general, like the law can only provide you with some crew, but every cases or every project has their own like context and a different perspective you have to pay attention, so you have to be creative to how to interpret the law, saying like I'm doing this and we can make sure that the stakeholders' opinions can be cherished or appreciated. And that's how I see sustainability. So
you speak that sustainability is like, it's kind of fresh content, but there's not a lot written about it. It's a lot of trial and error, and I kind of agree, but I also disagree. Okay. Because sustainability is a pretty, the way we understand sustainability or the way we refer to sustainability, it's just a new word for trying to describe how the world works. And so a lot of the academic writing, academic thinking that's coming out around sustainability, it's trying to understand the world that came before, and also trying to understand the world how where it should go, trying to match these two. And I'm trying to think of sustainability less as sustainability. It's like there's only a brief period in human history where we weren't sustainable. It's from the Industrial Revolution to now.
Yeah.
Before that, we were. Our cultures were based on it. Our lifestyles were based on sustainable living. But now that everything's so complex, we're trying to make connections with everything, trying to connect medicine and health to energy, to law, to politics, to society, to natural sciences, trying to make all these connections. And it's systems thinking, trying to understand how the system works. And to a degree, law is systems thinking. And that offers a way of making things creative. You have different laws, different acts, different statutes. And when it comes to a single case, you never refer to a single act or a single statute.
Yeah.
You have to make these connections. You have to understand how the system works and how everything relates to it. When you've looked at law and sustainability, have you made any of that connection? Like that, what you are doing is in a way systems thinking?
Because like in the past, like every state or like every statute, every act, just like you say, like they're like their own, you create a law or you establish a law, like almost like in the, like working in silos.
Mm.
They don't really connect. But nowadays you have to like to considering everything all together. So like environmental law is not just about environment. It's about the societies, about the economics. So like you kind of have to like to bring those kind of different perspective, different law principles all together.
Mm.
So that's also a law or a focusing on law called like transitioning law, a law in transition. Like there's a project called like Earth System Laws.
Earth system laws.
Yeah. So they're trying to focusing on like in the era of Anthropocene.
Mm-hmm.
Like in this era, like how we see law changes and what kind of like principles we should have to accommodate this era. So they kind of have like some kind of like principles like polluter pays and precautionary principles,
mm-hmm.
common but differentiate those kind of like principles that work. They think they should work for this era. I feel like this kind of like principles, it includes different perspective, not only just about like not like the past. It's a more like a holistic approach to make the law,
mm.
to interpret the law, and to find a way or a mechanisms to make sure the system works. And so for me, law becomes more a way or a science to a living science, to be honest.
Laws come from people.
Laws come from people.
Right? It comes from the way we observe our interactions, interacting with economies, with people, with the environment, which is the three pillars of sustainability.
Yeah.
You also said you're not creative, but it sounds like you are in a way. Like systems thinking, understanding how these connections are made so you can apply them in ways that people wouldn't have thought of. I think, I know it's not really your area, you're in carbon taxation, but probably the most topical new application of environmental law
mm-hmm.
to drive sustainable outcomes is around holding businesses and politicians accountable for future emissions and future climate change. And so you see a lot of climate litigation in
mm-hmm.
Australia, in America as well, with kids saying, you're not making decisions that are in our interests.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have any ideas or if you follow this at all or what your thoughts are.
Before I go to London, like we have a project at Environmental Rights Foundation, and that project working on how to initiate the climate litigation in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we also looking at some climate litigations around the world and try to learn from that and how to also incorporate this kind of trend into our climate change law. And but we failed, to be honest. But the good thing is, like, at least at that time, like every bill or every amendment had some kind of concepts about climate litigations. Because
mm-hmm.
Right now in Taiwan, like you can't really sue the government about climate change, because
mm-hmm.
you are not, because like legally we call like you don't have the standings.
Yeah.
So if you want to get the legal standings, you have to change the law to make sure that everyone have the right to sue the government.
It's not like people go, oh, now I have the power to sue the government, I'm just going to do that. There's a whole process involved. It costs a lot of money, it costs a lot of time.
Yeah.
Just because people have the ability to do so doesn't mean that every single person
will do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not the case. So like if the government is saying that I'm doing this and this, but like you're just not allowed to sue us, it just, and they're also saying like we already have this kind of like a lot of way for you to engage in the policy making process. Mm-hmm. Like if you are saying that, why are you afraid of this suit? If you really make sure that people are in the process, from the very first beginning of every policies, then there won't be any suits.
Yeah.
Right?
The suit is the contingency. If you haven't done your job correctly, then it will come.
Yeah.
But if it's being done properly beforehand,
then
you avoid or you mitigate a lot of that risk.
Yeah. It's just a way to, like a safeguard mechanism, for me. For me, the biggest thing for the climate mitigation is also to make sure that your governments take care of something they overlooked, and to make sure the other mechanisms to be enforced properly, like the public engagement, public participation, the supervise on the big emissions emitters are being enforced, the law are being enforced. So that's just a safeguard mechanisms. Like if you do your job properly.
Like my project at the moment is around public participation in environmental impact assessments, and comparing that to Taiwan's, to other countries. But it's a bit different because I'm looking at how it's applied to solar developments.
Mm-hmm.
And in Taiwan, EIA does not apply to solar. If you want to build a solar farm, you don't have to go through EIA.
Yeah.
And so looking at how, even if EIA was expanded to solar, are the provisions for public participation adequate to do so? Because just expanding the scope of a law doesn't make it better.
Yeah.
Improving its processes makes it better. And so looking at other countries, they have public participation, sometimes like the EU directive, public participation, they have a focus on it, but it's at the end. In Japan, they have public participation before scoping even occurs, like a pre-public participation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think some of the obstacles are for public participation in Taiwan? Like, it's just treated like public consultation.
Yeah.
You know, I've looked through a lot of environmental laws and they mention the public, but they mention that you need to consider the public, not to involve the public.
Yeah. For me, it's to clarify everything, this is like a disclaimer almost.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert of public participation. Personal opinion.
This is not from a public participation expertise, more from a you are Taiwanese.
Okay.
Your cultural expertise.
People doesn't really care.
Awesome. Who's the people? Like the at the grassroots don't care, or the government don't care?
It's just the general people. Sometimes they just don't care. I have to say that, sadly, like the general people, the citizens, like in terms of like energy transitions, right now in Taiwan, the most of the people doesn't really have a clue on energy transitions.
Mm-hmm.
They see climate change as a problem, sure, but they don't really care or put it into actions. So if you want them to engage, they will probably say, why should I engage? What kind of efforts or what kind of things can I do? I feel like the public participation before a meaningful public participation in Taiwan, I feel like empowerment your people, it's the first thing, the most important thing you have to do in Taiwan. You have to to increase the awareness on climate change, on energy transitions, and to tell them why this project related to you. You have to find connections, otherwise they don't understand what kind of connections, what's the hustle I have to participate in this whole process.
in English we say you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you were to say, here is the public participation, this is the process, these are the windows of time, here's the place you can comment, this is all very robust.
Just drink the water.
But you can't just say, yeah, drink the water. You can't say, participate. Now, give us feedback.
Yeah.
Be interesting. The question is, is it the government's responsibility to empower? Is their responsibility to have a good process for public participation, but is it their responsibility for empowerment? I think that's a very different question that neither of us have the expertise to answer. Goes back to the systems thinking that we're talking about, like how transdisciplinary sustainability is, incorporating so many different elements.
Yeah.
And this public participation and empowerment, public participation could be, say, a legal question, but then the empowerment becomes a social science question.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different skill sets and different academic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also, you also have to really understand what your people want.
Mm.
Everybody have different experience, have different backgrounds, so it's also a way to how you communicate to your people. Do you feel like in general, like in Australia, like people cares about sustainability?
I would say yes. So we had the climate elections, the past few elections, and I think it kind of reached its fever pitch at last year's election, when we had just had enough of the previous Conservative government. Having the same government in power for nearly 13 years obviously will do it, but the mismanagement over energy policy, on implementing the Paris Climate Agreement and setting our NDCs. And I don't think people would know too much about the general population would know too much about that, but just the overall political discourse around climate change and sustainability, you could tell that previous elections, it was people voting in favor for parties that were strong in favor for action. And then last year, that party won. And not only did that Progressive Party win the most seats at the election, but also the Greens Party won many seats at that election.
Okay.
And then the other big move was, they were called the Teal Candidates. So in Australia politics, we have colours as well. So the Blue Party is the Conservative Party, fiscally conservative. The Red Party is for labour rights and for social progressive policies. And then there's the Green Party, which is environmental sustainability, climate action.
Okay.
And so the Teals were a mixture of the Blue, fiscally, economically conservative, and Green, who were socially progressive and environmentally friendly. And these Teals would usually run as independents, but they had some national kind of networking and collaboration, in which they went from having zero Teal candidates at the previous election and none winning. Obviously, there's no candidates. So this election, there were seven.
Okay.
I believe seven that won across various places in Australia. And they didn't take seats away from the Red Party or the Green Party. They were mostly won in those Conservative Blue parties.
Okay.
Blue seats.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I think, really shows that there's a big group that supports, has always supported, more progressive policies around the environment and climate action. But then seeing these people who usually vote conservative now voting for Teals, who are voting, the main point of difference being environmental sustainability and climate action, shows that a more a bigger part of the population is starting to care about these.
Okay. But do you feel like it's because the natural disasters happens?
Well, yeah, natural disasters help. And when you have the biggest bushfire in Australian history, 1 year in which a billion marsupials died, not a billion marsupials, 1 to 3 billion animals died.
Yeah.
And then you have that smoke choking up both Melbourne and Sydney, the two largest cities, and it's spanning the land area around four times the size of the UK for just one fire event, for one fire season. And then the next year was followed up by flooding.
Okay.
In the same areas that had bushfires.
Mm-hmm.
And the next year was also flooding because of the back-to-back La Nina. Mm. But these were places that were sometimes had three weather events back-to-back-to-back.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became very much part of the discourse. People were aware that, yes, Australia has flooding and fires before, but we've never seen them on this scale.
Okay.
What is going on?
Okay.
And people started to respond to that.
Okay. But you were saying about to respond to climate change.
Mm.
Can you elaborate more on what kind of a response the most Australians, how do they respond to climate change?
The people in general?
Yeah, people in general. Or how they expect the governments to do, what kind of climate response? Like more, like if you want, more like a mitigation part or an adaptation part?
I think most of the responses around mitigation in the energy sector.
Okay.
And in, to a degree, transportation, but when it comes to personal transportation, Australians love cars. They are a petro state in a way.
Why you like cars?
Well, you've never been to Australia, but you cannot go anywhere without a car.
Okay.
Public transport is non-existent unless you live in a major city, but even still, your closest train station might be 20-minute drive away.
Okay.
So if you don't get the bus to the train station, and the buses come three times an hour, it might take you 40 minutes to get to the train station on a bus, and then you need to get 40 minutes into the city.
Okay.
You drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in a best case scenario. Otherwise, if you want to go to your friend's house that's on the other side of the city, and public transport in my city, Melbourne, it's a hub and spoke. Every train goes into the city, turns around, and then comes back out. So you have the circle, then you have each spoke coming out in different directions, and there's nothing to connect them.
You need to drive. Smart, right? Okay.
So the response has been to add solar panels to their rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably more about a cost-saving measure more than a climate action.
Okay.
But there are people who do it for climate reasons. But yeah, just trying to demand coherent energy policy.
Okay.
Because that's something that's lacked.
Okay. Are people willing to pay more for their bills, or...?
It's a hard question to answer. I haven't lived in Australia for like 4 years, but I paid an electricity bill in Australia for like 4 years. But from my understanding, reading the news and talking with my friends and family, is that the cost of heating and electricity has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't necessarily because of the addition of solar and wind. It's been because of additions to the grid. So extra networking and wiring, there's been fees levied on that, and then there's also the retail cost as well. And then in winter, a lot of Australian houses use gas for heating, and Australia produces a lot of gas, but it's also an exporter of gas. We export something like 90% or something of the gas that we produce. And so the prices domestically are heavily influenced by the international market. And the pinch was felt most during winter when people couldn't afford to heat up their houses. It wasn't because we didn't have enough electricity, it was because gas prices were too high. And we know why gas prices were high last year was because of the Ukraine war.
The mining industry in Australia is public or privatized?
There's a very vocal group who is opposed to all mining of fossil fuels in Australia.
Okay.
So we definitely have a lot of protests and activism around that.
Mm-hmm.
Ends up in the news a lot. this more progressive party that came in last year has said that gas and coal will still be a part of Australia's economy going forward. So, you know, there's a lot of debate around what use changing the government was if they're just going to maintain a lot of the same policy. I think gas is less contentious than coal, just because there's been a lot of good marketing around gases, you know, natural gas. And
natural.
It has less emissions when you burn it, up to 50% less. And that it's going to be a transition fuel. So there's lots of these great narratives being built that has led to Australians supporting it. Oh yeah, we need to export gas. So the war in Ukraine, countries need our gas. If we don't export our gas, other countries will fill this demand. But coal, on the other hand, I think people are pretty over coal, especially in Victoria, my home state. We actually mine and use a lot of brown coal. Very cheap, very dirty, highly polluting, and there's some praise when a thermal coal plant gets turned off, but there's also a lot of condemnation. So it's still very split. These climate wars have, the climate wars have still kind of perpetuated in the background, but it's we've at least settled, I believe, as a country, that climate change is in fact a reality, and that humans are being the cause. I think that's being mostly put behind us. It's just around how to reach these targets at the speed at which we do it is what's being debated over now.
Do you see there's a change in like numbers of like universities programs that focusing on sustainability?
At first I thought yes.
Okay.
You know, I studied the Master of Sustainability at the University of Sydney. And apparently this is one of the first and only dedicated sustainability masters in Australia. I was looking around because Sydney wasn't my first preference. And there was environment and development at Melbourne. I did a diploma of sustainable living at the University of Tasmania, but they don't have a master's in that sustainability. I don't even know if they go up to a bachelor's for that. But as a whole, you know, just because there's no dedicated sustainability master's, we have a lot of environmental science. We have development studies. So there's a lot of people working on it. There's a lot of courses to it, but it's more of the specialized, more of the hard skills rather than like a social science-based sustainability that focuses on... A lot of the focus on my master's has been around business. Like a lot of the my classmates are interested in business and ESG.
ESG, of course.
Something you're interested in.
Yeah.
But I'm more interested in policy and governance.
Okay.
And so there's a bit of a disconnect between my understanding of the two halves.
Okay. The reason I'm asking this because my professor just told me that I took a class called Business and Human Rights when I was in London. And he told me that in the past 3 years, his class is not the most popular one.
Not the most.
Not the most popular.
Is it becoming more popular or less? Is there a trend?
It's become more popular.
Okay.
So I think in like 3 years, the past 3 years, like the average students like taking the courses, it's around like 15.
Okay.
Or like 20, but we have like 500 students a year. So it's, you can see like it's not very popular.
No.
Definitely not. So, but like this year we have increased to like almost like 50 or 60.
Wow.
So he kind of feel like it becoming a trend. And it's becoming... Like he he's not sure about what changed the student's mind, but he feels like the generation has arrived.
The generation's arrived. We're here.
And he also have an observation about the demographic, I guess, in the class.
I was gonna ask, like, yeah, if it's a reflection of the multiculturalism of the course itself. I don't know, your classmates or what you know, how much of the classmates were.
Yeah, in our program, like 500 of us, like I think like 1/5 of us from China.
Mm-hmm.
The other 1/5 is from India.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3/5 of the students from over the world.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about percentage from like the UK home-based students?
It's less, very less.
Very less.
I think I just talked to maybe 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that they are British, like maybe 3 or 4, I guess. But I don't really know about it. Like, I think like most of us are like foreign students. And but in the class, in the business and human rights classes, the professor told me like 50 or 60% of us, like I think half of us, are from Asian countries.
Mm.
So he's also kind of surprised that it seems like Asian countries are being more aware of this topic. Maybe we're caring more about the ESG things or the sustainability things, but he doesn't.
Do you think it's because people who are coming from other countries, other Asian countries, they might have development more on their mind, like how can I learn and then come back and make my country better, rather than what job is going to make me the most money, so I'm just going to do that? I think there might be a combination of the two.
Okay.
But in terms of trying to bring back skills and knowledge to their home country to make a difference,
I think it's the later.
Okay.
The later is to make money.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how I see my peers. Yeah, because a lot of them, like students from China, like I think most of them, they just have their graduate from their bachelor degree.
Mm.
And they don't really have some kind of like working experience, so they're always like, they're, one of them just being very blunt to me, saying like, we are come here to London for not the gain knowledge, but we are here just for a degree. So like, I was like, oh, if you say so. Okay, I was like not that surprised.
Yeah.
I understand that in some way, because they told me like in China, like there's only one day for you to have the like the exam for your master.
Mm.
And you can only choose one program a year to choose like what kind of like program you want to enter in, and you have only one day to take the exam. So it's really hard to get any one of them.
Yeah.
So it's just easier for them if you want to have a master degree abroad.
I think that would be probably one of the biggest differences then between a law degree, a master's of law, that you've focused on environmental law, sustainability, compared to a sustainability focused. In my course, at least half of the people that I see on a regular basis speak English as a second language.
Right.
And most of them, because they've come from different countries, not that they've lived in Australia or came recently during high school, they've come to upskill themselves, be qualified with a high quality degree, but they all have intention of going back and helping their countries.
The countries.
I have friends from Nepal and Thailand, Philippines, Mexico, all from very various walks of life, and they're all intention to go back and go into business or go into government and make a change.
Make a change, yeah.
Make a change. And it's pretty cool. Like I sometimes when I'm just chatting with my friends in class, and I look down the line, and I think, I'm the only Australian English-speaking first language. Mm-hmm. Everyone here, we're all collaborating because we have a goal in mind, not because we share a cultural background.
Yeah.
And it's very inspiring. So I've really enjoyed that aspect of my course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I talked to... I have my peer in London.
Mm-hmm.
And in classes. My classes, Matt's like... We have 500 of us, but like I think my group is only like 10 of us. Yeah, there's no native English speaker.
Mm.
Most of them are from like European countries and some Asian countries, but like we are not like native English speakers.
Yeah,
and we don't really necessarily like have the same values, but. Every one of us like cherish the sustainabilities like more, or at least have some clue about it.
That's a value.
That's a value, but and like I mean,
caring about the long term fate of the.
But how you perceive sustainability, or how you want to like make your like make sustainability as your how you I mean like how you want to.
Action on it.
Yeah.
What do you think sustainability and green development looks like in Taiwan over the next 10 years, 20 years, in terms of legal, social, technical aspects?
If to be honest, if the I think I'm positive on this question,
mm-hmm.
and if the world keeps becoming more sustainable and the supply chain is becoming more sustainable,
mm-hmm.
then we will follow.
So once there's enough pressure on Taiwan, then something might start changing in Taiwan.
I kind of feel like that. But I feel like the people in Taiwan are more can be more appreciate the environment maybe than other like Western countries people, because
mm-hmm.
from my experience or observation, I feel like in London, for example, people don't bring their own bottle.
Yeah,
they just don't care. So for me, I kind of surprised. I feel like before I go to like study in London, I feel like oh, you're European countries people.
Mm-hmm.
You should know like. Bring your bottle,
yeah,
like to every coffee shop, like. But honestly, it's just not the case, and you can see people just throwing everything, and without recycling everything. So for this part, I kind of have faith,
mm-hmm.
and have, like, I'm optimistic on this part of Taiwan. So I believe that my peers or my people are more progressive on this part. So
that's good to end on a positive note.
Right? Believe in yourself.
Thank you for listening. Bye bye.
See ya.